Well, I was asked to do storytelling this summer and with this water theme, and I am not really good with nature metaphors, and I easily feel that they become cheesy, and I'm probably too cynical about them. And I told Kathleen this would not be a good sermon, a good day for me to storytell here. So don't brace yourself for expansive nature metaphors. There is a scene in what I'm about to share that's called water, but it's not meant to be like the big water thing. Am I still too quiet, Michael? Good? Okay. All right, so three scenes. Scene one, football.
SK Sturm Siegel für uns, ist der Chant. Sportclub Sturm, win for us.
SK Sturm Graz is one of the two football or soccer teams in the town that I grew up close to in Austria. The other one was formed by academics. They are red and white. We are black and white. We are more the team of the unwashed masses. At least that's the founding myth. And this chant in the stadium on a game day is a kind of a black and white liturgy. Next you yell, SK Sturm kämpfe für uns, fight for us. And then schieß ein Tor für uns, score a goal for us. And then the whole Nordkurve, the area of the stadium on the north where the hardcore fans hang out, burst into the triumphal march from Giuseppe Verdi's opera Aida. And the moment the song breaks up, a few thousand arms are raised and everyone shouts, Wiener Schweine, Viennese pigs. Because we're playing one of the two teams from Vienna today. This ritual insult is absolutely necessary. Linzer Schweine, when we play a team from Linz, Bullenschweine, when we play the team from Salzburg, which is sponsored by Red Bull, and so on. It's our green match warm-up. It's quite simple. We're not primarily here to delight in players. Players are great, but they come and go, such is the way of football capitalism. But we are here to advance and represent the club, the crest, the colors, black and white, in this case. Sturm covers all that is black in my life. Ivica Osim, our legendary Bosnian coach of the 1990s, once said, after our club's colors, and all that is white, too. He said deep things like that sometimes, randomly, when somebody asked him if he was happy with today's game. He had degrees in philosophy and in mathematics, and he was from Sarajevo, coached Sturm to the greatest successes of its history in the 90s, while his own native town was laid to ruins in the Yugoslavian Civil War. Covers all that is black, and all that is white, too. And in the stands that day, or those days, the black and the white covered us, smudged over our individual worries and fears and demarcation lines, graduate student and bricklayer, bank employee and musician, tech wizard and farmer. But no other occasion distills this sense of insanity, hilarity, unease, and wild enchantment more than following your club to away games. I had that pleasure once with the English team that found my second vein of loyalty 8 years ago, West Ham United, founded as a club of East London iron workers, always bent over by a sense of significance that's never matched by the size of our budget. The club has a supporter base from a heavily Brexit voting, but also heavily migrant worker area of England, a large following, even by English standards, that makes no sense in light of the complete lack of titles that the club has worn for decades. And that riffraff of the fashionable and gentrifying British capital took its reputation on a train journey to the English north, to Newcastle, one late summer day, and I'd been fixed up with an aftermarket ticket via an online forum just a week before. I had to change trains at Newcastle main station on the way from Oxford to conference in Edinburgh just a week before that game. And I stepped out of that train and changed it on the one to the conference, heady with the brilliant paper I was about to give, carrying the extra books that wouldn't fit my backpack in my hands. And instead, here I suddenly was again in the same station that looks like a temple, Romano-Italian is what a plaque there says, standing in a solid group of West Ham supporters who were yelling crude insults to our crosstown rival Tottenham, who we weren't even playing that day, and introducing themselves to their host city by chanting, "We are the bastards in claret and blue," that's the West Ham colors, and just generally intimidating the railway staff and some Japanese tourists and Newcastle citizens who wouldn't have turned up their nose at me a week ago. And in that magical way that can happen in a crowd, I'm standing between a meek teacher friend of the guy who fixed me up with a ticket and who I had lost on the train up there, which was quite chaotic. And on the other hand, a group of few massive men who had clearly spent their train journey up there with beer or cocaine, and on we marched up to the stadium. We cut a fine figure, for sure. At that moment, I thoroughly enjoyed not having to explain myself, my degrees, my studies, what theory of religious studies or cultural studies I was working on at the moment before I got here. When I came to assembly, I didn't have to do that either. And I remain hesitant to bring my job to church. Though some of you know I teach American history at the college, much of it on migration, ethnicity, religion, and race. I received much care and healing and an occasional kick in the butt when I began attending here, all of which I needed. Assembly has its own perfectionisms, but it does have a remarkable breadth of life experience and a great tolerance for them. And as a single parent in a very difficult phase of life, I felt that breadth and tolerance, the space to find some peace rather than fit in immediately. I sensed that that space was greater here than it would have been elsewhere, and I still think that. What I've described are moments of resonance. Hartmut Rosa is a German sociologist who has tried to describe what that means, resonance. And I'm sure you can all identify some of the features, some of these moments that I've explained as well. For one, a feeling of being truly touched by something or someone in a moment. Second, an emotional response to that. Third, a sense of transformation, the kinds of moments where you say, I haven't been the same person afterwards. And fourth, a sense of unpredictability. Uncontrollability. You can't make resonance happen. Right? I'm interested in this. Scholars generally focus on the opposite of resonance, which is alienation. Right? What isn't right? What separates people from each other and from the world, from themselves? I don't want to bother with the academic issue, but I do know the opposite of resonance as well. The opposite of the feelings I've just described. I know alienation and how it feels to be out of sync, too, with myself and with others. So, scene two, water. The house I purchased 4 years ago has a little two-bedroom apartment out back towards 7th Street. I rented out the two GC alums. And on this warm fall day, the shower faucet was dripping again. Steve Shantz came over. And I watched as he tried different screws, and chipper as always, explained to me what was likely going on here and what was wrong. And between Steve and Menard, there was a solution, at least temporarily. It's a cheap plastic kind of shower wall, you know. I like Steve, and I like Menards. And when we stepped outside, I pointed out to him that water hadn't just intruded into the shower when I didn't ask him to, but also swamped the area around our outdoor fire pit the day before, from rain. And when water intrudes there, little white mushrooms appear from a tree stump that must have been on the ground there under our large deck for quite a while.
I hate
the look of these mushrooms, I told Steve. How can I possibly kill them? I'd even dig up the ground, pretty much any chemical I'd use. I'm not a lawn Nazi, but these things are ugly. Steve responded, a fairy ring, almost with a sense of enchantment. And he volunteered a brief story about soil and healthy things, things like that. He may have even called him beautiful. I think I let the topic go. And I grumbled to myself afterwards that perhaps as a good Mennonite, I should feel a little bit more nature-y, outdoorsy, sustainably Wendell Berry-ish, you know, about the mushrooms like Steve does. I should be able to imagine stories about the dead tree like Aaron would be able to. I should share my dad's loves for hikes and mountains and scenery and ground more. But the truth is, I never got easily enchanted with nature other than scenery from a distance, like generic hills, flat horizons, lakes. Don't get me wrong, I like those, love them even. I love the Midwest landscape. But I find people much more interesting, weird people, and community, weird communities. I may be the only Goshenite who found the brutalist jail downtown worth keeping, since it even extends to the built environment. And football stadiums, of course, they're temples. My small group knows my provocative thesis that going camping is to deny human evolution. And though I'm not an extrovert, I would find an hour talking with a worker on the floor of Flipper or Keystone about their life more life-giving than bird watching. 9 out of 10 chances, I guess. And I don't always like that there's not as much resonance there as my social environment among well-educated progressive folks suggests to me that there should be. Some of the most painful phases of my life have come when I tried to force such resonance, when it isn't there. You know, if he would read that article that I've written, he would like me more. If I knew more about the topic, I would get invited along for dinner at this conference. If I dressed more like these well-adjusted middle-class American dads, I'd fit in better. If I was good at this sport, I would feel more belonging. If I retweeted this post, if I posted how upset I was, a me too, about that particular bit of news on Facebook, even if I'm not, then the cool kids might see that I'm one of theirs. That trying to make resonance happen can extend to living here with and among you. The truth is, temperamentally, I will always be different from well-adjusted GC alumni. I like good arguments, and my musical taste and my sense of humor are colored more by my European upbringing. As for church, I love four-part harmony, and I love to sing, but I didn't grow up in a church that sang, and so I'm sometimes the fifth part in a four-part harmony. Now, theologically, assembly and the way I think about God and Jesus fits well. The whole history of the Central District Mennonite Conference, if you want to talk to me about that sometime, I think fits me great. And the story of global Anabaptism, this ragtag story of accelerating encounters, I think was God's way of drawing me here, and fits me great too. But also, sometimes I must say I've bitten my tongue during services, when I felt that rather knee-jerk talking points entered our service unchecked through social media's waves of predictable outrage. And when it seemed like we took an odd kind of pleasure in sounding apocalyptic or morally superior at times. So there isn't necessarily always a black and a white to cover everything in my life here in America or among Mennonites or among academics in my job. There isn't always resonance. There's also alienation. This is just supposed to be my story. I don't claim to be unique in any way here, and to feel a little outside, to feel a little out of sync, is being human. And to try to fit in, nevertheless, is being human too. So I have felt resonance among you and in the stands of football grounds, and I have felt alienation. Normal. It's just that when I hang on to feeling different, outside, alienated, like a badge of honor or a mark of my genius or specialness, I'm killing any chance of resonance. It's easy to hang on to my sense of alienation, and I'm pretty sure you can relate to what I mean. The world doesn't go the way I think it should, so I grumble. My own life choices have been wrong, but I won't admit it, so I eat my regret. Other people's life doesn't resonate with me, so I scheme and maneuver. And I'm clearly more brilliant than they and see connections they don't see, so I hold grudges. And I hold grudges because surely someday someone will see those grudges as justified and set the world right and set the other people right. You know what that is? It's an emotional hangover. Which brings me to final scene 3, Woods. For 4 years now, one weeknight every week, I meet with anywhere between 3 and 9 people around the fire pit in Whitmer Woods for about an hour. They might work on Elkhart County's assembly lines, the ones in factories, not ours, or they're carpenters or roofers or teachers or currently live in the work release site on the north side of town or to graduate students, or grandparents. Some of us are Mennonite, some of us are Amish. There's often laughter and stories of small and big successes, or laughter over past mistakes, big and small. A lot of honesty, some silence, and good serious talk about life. And stories, always stories, our stories. We meet, you see, because all of us thought we were special and very different ones. And the world didn't see it, and it was easy for us to feel alienated. And sometimes we loved that feeling too much and pushed people away with it. And when we didn't love it, our coping mechanisms for that sense of alienation took us to the bottom, any kind of bottom, emotionally, physically, financially, mentally. How do you know you've hit bottom? Well, quit digging. That's a cliche. It's one of many cliches I hear in that small group that sinks in after I stop thinking of myself as too smart for them. Every day is a gift. That's why we call it the present. It's not a present. Easy does it. Ask for help. The elevator is broken. You've got to use 12 steps. Just do the next right thing one day at a time. And your smartest thinking has gotten you here. They told me, so here you are, and you can borrow our cliches and our higher power even, provided you no longer think it's you, until you feel like a human among humans again, until you feel resonance, and until it gets easier. And life does get easier. What's your name? You ask. Philip. Hi, Philip. Here's my damage. And that's where the slow magic happens. On those evenings, my stories are hardly the best ones in that space. It can feel like a potluck, where all I brought was a plastic fork and pretzels. But I also know that me being there is one of the small parts that allows our group to happen at all, my body there, along with everybody else. People aren't dazzled by anything I have to say or by how I say it. It's just the opposite of preaching or teaching. They just listen. Yeah, that was me too, somebody might say. I'm not supposed to tell my story because it's better than anybody else's. Or worse than anybody else's, or even that special. But because it's just the story I have. And that takes away some of that righteous sense of alienation, because it could be anyone. It could have been anyone's story. And that it could be anyone, it's not that special, that felt to me like erasure first. Leslie Jameson, who's a writer and literature prof at Columbia University, asks the same questions I have. Giving up on singularity was like giving up on the edges of my body. What would I be if I wasn't singular? What was identity if it wasn't fundamentally a question of difference? What defined a voice if not distinction? Who am I if I don't get to pick and nurture my sense of otherness and of alienation? If everything is covered by black and white? And if we are the bastards in claret and blue, and if the books in my backpack and my grudges about the rest of the world aren't important. I mean, I'm still in a job where I'm often expected to be the smartest person in the room, and if I'm not, I'm conditioned to want to be. But letting these other stories wash over me has tempered those urges. Their prose may not be as polished as assembly sermons, and there might be a few F-words in there. But whenever someone else around that fire says something simple and true, I want to feel that. And when I speak, I want to speak with a truth that I can't rank others' stories. I can only speak my own and leave it at that. And I never know where it might land in somebody else's life, just like some of their stories landed in my life when I needed them the most, just like their damage can give me hope because I can identify, not compare. Not rank. Writer Joan Didion famously said that we tell ourselves stories in order to live. And you might know that quote pulled out from her. But if you read on from there, you get the sense that she sees stories as a bit of a crutch, as a bit of a naive refusal to deal with actual life. But I do believe that stories, even if curated, do us, maybe somebody else, some good. In this case, we don't tell ourselves stories in order to live. We tell others our stories in order to help them live too. To learn how to resonate again. The paradox of such stories, I've been learning, is that I'm supposed to relinquish my ego and curb that sense of alienation precisely by telling a story in which I feature. It's a paradox. It's made possible by acknowledging commonality. I happen to be at the center of this story, but really anyone could be. When philosopher Gilles Deleuze wrote that life isn't personal, he was getting at this too. That an individual story is both more and less than self-expression. My devils aren't just mine. Others have seen them too. And what am I supposed to conclude from the fact that I recognize the devils that some person with a completely different cultural, social background than I have has seen 10, 20 years ago as my own? I'm probably supposed to conclude that I have much more in common with other human beings than what separates me from them. I'd be remiss not to mention that if you feel like such a space could be good for you, come look us up. We're easy to find right at the beginning of the phone book. As former Late Late Show host Craig Ferguson once said, you never know, because it could be anyone. It could be anyone's story, anyone's bottom. 15 minutes ago, I said, at that moment, I thoroughly enjoyed not having to explain myself, my degrees, my studies, what theory of religious studies or cultural studies I'd read up on before I got here. I said that about the Newcastle train station. And I enjoy such moments still. We are the bastards in claret and blue. And we are the church that welcomes life journeys that aren't perfect. And we are the ones whose journey from alienation to resonance is just beginning. And the ones who are afraid of life continuing the way it is. But we've seen the stories ahead. And we've said that could be me. Somewhere in there, among other humans, that could be me. There could be resonance.